Hello, everybody. Just a quick note before the show actually begins in earnest. The recording session where we laid down the audio for this upcoming bonus episode that you're about to listen to was actually recorded during a period where there's a really bad thunderstorm in the city that I live in. It was actually so bad that there was a moment in which the thunder was loud enough to peak my microphone from inside my house. And just, you know, unfortunately, because of the way that we record this show, it's not always easy to tell what audio issues there may be until after we actually pull like the raw data and Cody sorts through it and does his magic with editing. So the episode is, you know, it's fine. Like, you're going to be able to listen to it and follow it as anything else, but there is some moments, particularly in the first 8 minutes or so, where my voice maybe sounds a bit off or like a bit sped up almost. And then there are some moments in the middle and towards the end where just for random seconds at a time, my voice just kind of drops out. It's not so bad to where you can't, you know, alight what I'm saying or pick up on what it is that I'm saying. But, you know, if we release this episode and everyone thinks it's so terrible that it's unlistenable, then I'm more than happy to re-record it for you just so that you have something, you know, pleasurable to listen to. But without further ado, here is my bonus episode on Otessa Moshfegh. Hello, and thank you for listening to Mapping the Zone, a podcast that is currently about whatever we want it to be about, but is normally about highly fixated reviews of large, dense books, particularly those of Thomas Pynchon, the postmodern American author most famous for 1973's Gravity's Rainbow. But that's not what we're talking about today. Currently, we are going through our bonus episodes that are going to bridge the gap between our coverage of Vinland and our upcoming coverage of Bleeding Edge. Hopefully you've been joining these so far. This should be the third one, or actually fourth one that you'll be getting. We're giving you an extra one this time through. And just like last time, for all of the sort of host-specific episodes, we pick a piece of media, or, you know, art or entertainment, whatever term you want to apply there, that we really sort of connect to and resonate with and just have a chance to talk about it. Talk to the fellow hosts about it, and then, by extension, you, the listeners. Apologies for my voice maybe sounding weirder than normal. I picked up an illness from a mosh pit at a thrash metal show that I went to last week. And am still in the throes of that. So I'm going to do my best to still keep the energy level where it normally is, but that's where we're at right now. I was going to do an episode on the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, which is one of my favorite films, probably my favorite Western movie. But I ended up with a schedule far more loaded with work than I anticipated. And in the course of working 13 days in a row before working another 5 in a row, I did not have time to watch the assassination of Jesse James.
That sentence just made me tired.
Yeah, you know how I feel, Cody. And then to think, oh, get a great idea on my day off to go to a concert, and then to get sick from said concert. Yeah, so we're going through it over here. What I am going to be talking about instead of the assassination of Jesse James is another book within the canon of sort of young women who are writing these days. Honestly, the response to the last episode that I did on this was kind of unprecedented. You know, I thought that it was sort of a pretty niche topic to get into, and certainly wasn't niche from the standpoint of how many people wanted to listen to that episode and downloaded it. So thank you to everyone who really interacted with that episode and listened to it and must have recommended it to other people. If I'm not mistaken, Cody, that's still one of our like highest downloaded episodes to date.
It is.
So I figured that we would do another episode in that same vein. And especially after I talked about it a little bit in the discussion that we released a couple weeks ago between me and Will, and in the episode where I talked about Our Wives Under the Sea, I figure that now would be a fitting time to introduce Otessa Moshfegh to the canon of our bonus episodes. And Otessa Moshfegh is mostly known for Our Year of Rest and Relaxation, but that is not the book that I'm going to be talking about today. I am instead going to be talking about the book that she published immediately after that, which is called Death in Her Hands. I don't believe anyone else on the show has read her work or has explored her writing. Am I wrong about that, you guys?
I have not. She is on my to-read list after you mentioned her a while back. But yeah, I haven't read anything yet.
Okay.
Yeah, same. I think for some reason I feel like she wrote like some essay or something that I read, but yeah, no, not familiar with her work.
Gotcha. So to me, I think that if I was to pick a starting point for whatever the genre of literature is that I laid out in my last bonus episode that we released, I think I would start with Otessa Moshfegh. She seems to be the person doing this the earliest. This is all a very, very recent trend. And by recent, I mean in the mid to late 2010s and now into the 2020s. For those who don't know, Otessa Moshfegh is an American author. She is most famous, as I already mentioned, for her book, My Year of Rest and Relaxation. However, her debut novel, Eileen, did win the Hemingway Foundation Pen Award. It was also shortlisted that year for the Booker Prize. It was also a fiction finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, which is just sort of an additional award category that runs kind of concurrent to the National Book Award every year. And she writes a lot about not just female experience, but a lot of female experience from a standpoint of, as I kind of laid out the Julia Armfield episode, women who are attempting to contextualize some aspect of their life or their whole life and to understand the meaning out of the experiences that they've gone through. She is a very interesting author to dive into the bibliography of, not just from a standpoint of the subject matter that she talks about, but also from sort of the reactions to her work. There are very few people who have kind of a down-the-line opinion of her work. It seems as though a lot of people either really, really love her or think that she's like some sort of curse on the modern publishing industry. Her books often deal with the innate horror of the human body in their descriptions of like injuries or bodily functions or gore. Not necessarily in a visceral sense, but in a sense of she really finds it interesting to mine out what it means to kind of be in this sort of sentient flesh, I guess is the best way that I can put it, and how that interacts with the intelligent, you know, life that we are and how those things overlap. She talks a lot about that as well in her writing. Her debut novel, Eileen, was also adapted into a movie early this year or late last year. It was one of those ones where it was on like film festivals first, so it's hard to tell what the actual release date was, which was absolutely excellent. If you have a chance to see Eileen, highly recommend it. One of my favorite movies of last year, and not just because it was an adaptation of her work. So all of that kind of table setting brings us back to this idea of her as kind of the progenitor of this medium. And the main reason why I say that she kind of is she, before she was a published author from a standpoint of her actual novels, she was writing a lot of short stories and essays that were primarily featured in the Paris Review. Those were later collected into a book called Homesick for Another World, which is just all of those writings from that period of her life. But all of that kind of predates sort of the rise of the fiction that I've been talking about in two bonus episodes in a row. And so if there was, you know, any kind of zeitgeist that she preceded or tapped into, I think it was the fact that she was publishing these stories, and then people sort of got a hold of them in the MFA circuit, and then realized that there was something really to be mined out of that in their own writing, and that was kind of, in my mind, what led to this development. So, all that out of the way, let's talk about Death in Her Hands. This book is, I think, probably, from what I can tell, the least talked about novel in her bibliography. Obviously, My Year of Rest and Relaxation is really high up there on the highest pedestal it can possibly be on, for a lot of the reasons that we talked about in the conversation between me and Will. It was a social media phenomenon. But even things like Lapvona, which was her newest novel published last year, that gets more buzz just because it sort of is the first one to come out since people have really discovered her work on a wider scale. Her first novel, Eileen, gets mentioned a lot more because of the adaptation, because of the awards that it got, because of the fact that it's technically a debut novel rather than a debut in total. And even her short story or her novella, McGlue, gets mentioned, I feel like, more than Death in Her Hands. I don't know why this book flew underneath the radar in the way that it did. I really don't. I wish someone could explain that to me. But I think it is an example of the fact that this type of writing that she and other women are doing isn't necessarily pigeonholed to just one age range of character or one type of experience. Yes, a lot of the people writing these stories in this genre, as I've talked about, are younger. They're you know, middle age to elder millennials from that generation. In some cases, maybe like the gap generation between Gen Z and millennial. But the protagonist of Death in Her Hands is an elderly woman past retirement age. And still, the types of writing that these authors are engaging in, the types of thematic depth that they're exploring, are just as resonant for an older protagonist as they are a protagonist. So oftentimes, a lot of the criticism levied at, you know, some of these books by people who don't like them is that it is only of one particular time or place, that it is only relatable to the author because they are of the same age or similar age to their protagonists or their characters, and then subsequently to the audience reading them. This is a book that breaks that mold and shows that this is a type of writing, that this is a type of thematic content that can be mined of all sorts of different types of characters and all sorts of different types of plots. And funny enough, it is, like I mentioned, probably the least talked about book from her bibliography. On a surface level, Death in Her Hands is about a retired woman who, after her husband dies, she decides to move. And she decides to move to sort of a remote town. And in this town, she finds a cabin that is available for purchase. Her name's Vesta. And Vesta decides to purchase this cabin, which has a, you know, section of wood that surrounds it. And it has a little sort of dock off to this lake that's in her same area. And she has a canoe that she can take out to, you know, this island in the middle of the lake. And she's just going to sort of spend her retirement years. She's 72 years old. She's up there in age, definitely. She's going to spend the rest of the time that she has left just sort of reading and relaxing and taking care of her dog and going on walks. And it's going to be a time for her, just for herself. And one day, she is walking through the woods with her dog, and she comes across a sheet of paper, just like regular notebook paper that's in the woods. And the note says, "Her name was Magda. Nobody will ever know who killed her. It wasn't me. Here is her dead body." However, there is no body anywhere around. She looks around, she steps into the woods a bit, she can't find a dead body anywhere. There's no signs of struggle, there's no weapons, there's no blood. Just this one note that was left there. And this sort of begins a... It's hard to say exactly without spoiling it, and I don't want to do that, because what this book is trying to do is merge the reader and the protagonist into one headspace. And that is something that it does very successfully with the way that it's written. But that discovery of the note basically starts this whole process in which Vesta decides that she's going to try and figure out what that means. Who is Magda? Who killed her? Where did she come from? Where did this note come from? Why is this on my property? And it kind of begins to turn into a detective novel, or at least a detective novel that's kind of turned on its head a bit, obviously, because the protagonist of this book is certainly not the prototypical detective. The way that it's written is certainly not, you know, prototypical of that genre. It doesn't have a lot of the trappings of noir, but it is this woman conducting an investigation into who this victim, supposed or otherwise, may be, and what her relation to it is. And the interesting thing that she does is firmly plants the reader in Vesta's head. Most of this book is written in internal monologue. As she goes about her days, taking care of her property, taking care of her dog, but then also venturing into town to try and figure out who this woman might be. And this is where I have to be very careful what I say, because again, I don't want to spoil this central aspect of this novel, but her investigation also intertwines with a retelling of the history of her marriage to her late husband. And the further she gets into her investigation into Magda, the further the reader gets to figure out about what kind of relationship she had with her husband and the way that that relationship changes. And from the beginning of the book to the end of the book, these two threads that exist together begin to unravel a bit and change and evolve into something completely different from their starting points. And when we finally reach the sort of climax or conclusion of the novel, they actually merge into one. And that is where Otessa Moshfegh is able to pull out a very heavy emotional synthesis of these two plot lines and how these two plot lines merge into a recontextualization of the entirety of her protagonist's life and the reader's understanding of the protagonist's life. And in many ways, the effectiveness of the novel comes from the fact that you are stuck within the headspace of Vesta, and she is an unreliable narrator. She isn't just old, but she is in the process of guesswork and fiction creation around who this murder victim may or may not be. And even though the reader sits in her head watching her make these guesses, come up with this backstory for the character, and then come in contact with things that seem to line up with her fantasy, you are kind of sold that this is the reality. You're kind of sold that this is the way things are, and that she has somehow come across something meaningful and true, even though you've been a part of the creation process. So as a result of that, Otessa is able to kind of successfully transfer the headspace of her character, this potentially senile, very old woman who's gone through a lot of trauma in her life, onto the reader. And so when her story concludes at the close of this book, it has an incredible emotional weight to it that is really hard to put into words. This is the first book that ever made me cry, like, profusely. And I mean, like, not tear up. When I finished this book, I was, like, weeping, and I had to go into the other room and hold my partner for a while at the time. Oh, wow. because of the meaningful impact of the end of this book. And she was very concerned for me because she'd never seen me react this way upon finishing a novel. But the way in which it plays with this central theme of understanding, extracting meaning from experience, and being able to successfully contextualize aspects of your life into an overall tapestry of the person you are, and the inherent agency versus lack of agency that women have in particular when it comes to relationships with men in particular, abusive particular. It's just an incredibly powerful piece of fiction writing. And I'm going to read some quotes here just to kind of give you guys an idea of the flavor here. So the first is just going to give you guys an idea of sort of what her narration style is like and goes back and forth between inventing these aspects of the this sort of story with her own. I'd need a name for this me, the writer of the note. At first I thought I'd need a name as just a placeholder, something lacking in personality so as not to describe the me too particularly. A name like the anonymous printed penmanship. It was important to keep an open mind. I could be anybody. But there was something to be gleaned from the serious and youthful ballpoint pen. The precise print, the strange non-admission, the nobodiness of I, blank. My husband's name, Walter, was one of my favorite names. Charlie was a good name for a dog, I thought. When we were feeling regal, I'd call him Charles. He did look regal sometimes, his ears perked up and eyes cast downward like a king on his throne. But he was too good natured to be truly kingly. He wasn't a snobbish dog. He was no poodle or setter or spaniel. I'd wanted a manly breed, and when I'd gone into the kennel in Monolith, there he'd been. Abandoned, they told me. Discovered 2 months ago in a black duffel bag on the banks of the river. Barely 3 weeks old. The only one of the litter to survive. I spent a minute piecing that together. What horror. And then, what a miracle. From then on, I pictured myself as the one who had come upon the black duffel in the mud, under the bridge where the river thins, and that I had unzipped the bag to find a huddled swarm of heady, raisin-colored pups, only one of them breathing. And that one was mine. Charlie. Can you imagine abandoning such dear little creatures? So in that quote, we have this fusion of her talking about the note. That's where she's talking about the ballpoint pen, the non-admission, with her husband, and then with this story about how she got her dog, and then her changing that story to insert herself into the same narrative, but with a fictive element. And then going forward, I have another quote of her kind of relating back to the deceased woman. What was this? What was I forgetting? Magda, is this you? What a strange responsibility it was to hold someone's death in your hands. Death seemed fragile, like crumpled paper, 1,000 years old. One false move and I could crush it. Death was old and brittle lace, the applique about to separate from the fine mesh threads, nearly shredded, hanging there, beautiful and delicate and about to disintegrate. Life wasn't like that. Life was robust, it was stubborn. Life took so much to ruin. One had to beat it out of the body. Even just the slightest seed of life, a fertilized egg, took payment, an expert, a machine, and an industrial vacuum. I'd heard. Life was persistent. There it was, every day. Each morning it woke me up. It was loud and brash, a bully, a lounge singer in a garish sequin dress, a runaway truck, a jackhammer, a brush fire, a canker sore. Death was different. It was tender, a mystery. Where was it, even? Why did anybody have to die? Walter, the Jews? How many innocent children? My thoughts lost their train. How did people go on with their lives as though death weren't all around them? There were theories. Heaven, hell, rebirth, and so forth. But did anyone really know? Was there an answer? How unfair it seemed to send the living off into death. Into the unknown, so cold. Blake must have understood the tragedy this was. It was right there in his words. Nobody will ever know who killed her. Why, God? I'd been too hard on Blake, I thought. Blake had given my poor Magda a place to rest. He'd tried his best with all that he had, a pen, a spiral notebook, the little black rocks, which I now remembered were still in the pocket of my coat. I stuck my hand in and felt them, sharp and gritty between my fingers. They were a comfort. They gave me some strength. Her name was Magda. Yes, Blake. We must insist on life. Acknowledge it. Never turn away from the dead.
And then... got one more here.
Where we kind of get into the kind of unraveling aspect of her psyche and the fact that she's reliable. That got me thrashing mentally. And then I thought of my loneliness, my approaching death, how nobody knew me, nobody cared. I thought of my parents long dead and how little love they'd given me. I thought of Walter, of his nauseatingly gentle caresses. Even when he meant to be tender, he was condescending and controlling. I'd never been loved properly. Nobody had ever said, "You're wonderful. Even your bitterness and neurotic energy are wonderful. Even your suspiciousness and your rigidity, your graying, thinning hair, your wrinkled thighs." I'd been young and beautiful once, and even then nobody kissed me and said, "How young and beautiful you are." Not unless they wanted something from me. And that was Walter. Always wanting something, some permission to be boastful, some permission to have power. I cried and cried, thinking of the love I could have had, had I never met that awful, deleterious, pompous man. So there's just a couple of quotes from the book that get into the different aspects of the narrative, characters, and how they're intertwined with the internal monologue of the aging woman who may or may not. And yeah, to really say anything else, spoil on in the, I don't want to do that because I think it robs some of the novel of its intended purpose in the way that it's written and structured and the interaction between them and the actual text on the page. I think that needs to be preserved for your first. So, that's all I've got. Do you guys have any questions?
I mean, it sounds like a really, the premise, as soon as you mentioned what it was about with finding the note and everything like that, I was already absolutely intrigued, and based on the selections that you read, the writing sounds really wonderful as well. So I'm definitely interested in checking it out.
It is. She's an excellent writer. Absolutely. But has unfortunately, I think, been unfairly judged on a surface level by a lot of people who are doing a close read.
Yeah, I'm more or less on the same page as Cody there. I am very intrigued by what you've read so far. Would you say that this is a good, would you say this is a good entry point to Moshfegh's work?
I don't think there's a bad entry point to Moshfegh's work. I think that all of them do. Of course, Lavona, notwithstanding, I haven't read it. But I think all of them do different things. You know, this is a book about someone surveying the whole of their life, sort of looking back and trying to contextualize it. My Year of Rest and Relaxation is more about recovery from a trauma, and sort of the things that we do to try and get through either trauma or the malaise of kind of early adulthood, and kind of the overall desire to sort of medicate yourself out of your problems. And then, you know, like McGlue is kind of, I don't even really know how to describe McGlue. McGlue's an interesting kind of detective novel where you're in the head of a drunken pirate the entire time. And then Eileen is certainly a film about kind of, or not a film, a book and subsequent film about sort of obsession and neuroticism. So they all do different things, but I think that Death in Her Hands is certainly as good of an entry point as any of her big three, I would say, being Eileen, Rest and Relaxation, and then this. I think it depends on sort of the flavor of what you're looking out of your book at that time.
I don't have any questions. I feel like any questions I ask would dive too far into what the book is about. I don't want to spoil anything.
Sure.
So I'm going to refrain from asking those questions.
Yeah.
But I get, you know, you were spot on with recommending Our Wives Under the Sea, because that was a phenomenal read. So I have no doubt that this is also going to be a good one.
Well, thank you. I hope so.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you sell me with a unreliable narrator told as a, you know, a monologue. Yeah, that sounds right up my alley.
Yeah, then you would especially like this one, and you'd also like McGlue. Those would be the two that you'd really like. McGlue is about this drunken sailor pirate guy who wakes up in a jail cell, still drunk, and is trying to figure out kind of like how he ended up there, is what that novella is about. And he is also an unreliable because he's drunk the entire time.
Very fun.
Yeah, and that one's, so you definitely like that one. You also like this for sure. Well, as with the last episode I did on these types of books, if you guys have any additional recommendations for them, you guys being the listeners, please email them to me at our email address. I would love what you've read and what you've enjoyed out of this kind of writing. It's something where I think predominantly the types of books that I'm buying nowadays land in this type of genre. So if there's anything you guys have discovered, please do let me know. And if you've read this book, or if you read any of the other big books in this kind of emerging genre, I would love to hear about them. I'd love to correspond with you about it. Most of the people that I talk to on a daily basis don't know about these kinds of things. So I'd love to get into more conversation about it. But I think that's going to do it for this episode of bonus content. Next week we'll be back again with an episode from Luke on his chosen media. No idea what that's going to be, but I'm excited to hear about it. Until next week, have a great rest of your week. I don't know what I'm saying at this point. The cough medicine is really just making me kind of ramble on, I think, at this point. So I'm just gonna say bye
bye
bye.
Mwah.